The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. I'm Miriam Spector. And I want to welcome you to the library tonight. I am a board member here as well as chair of the Pepper Society, which is the library's annual giving support group, which makes possible such wonderful programs as story hours for preschoolers, summer reading, the Youth Summit, daily programs in all of our 54 branches, the GED training, tax form help, computer learning, and all kinds of wonderful things here at the Free Library and at our branches. For a complete listing of other things that are going on at the library, I urge you to visit the library's website, which is freelibrary.org. And while you're there, take some time to explore some of the site's new features, including downloadable ebooks and audiobooks, as well as streaming audio databases. All you need to access these and so many other resources on your home computer is your library card and PIN. I got it upside down. Remember our motto, exercise your right to be informed. If you don't have a library card and you would like one, please ask at the information desk upstairs when you go upstairs. Before I introduce our special guests, I will remind you, of course, to please turn off your cell phones and to tell you that after our author's presentations tonight, and a few minutes for Q&A, there will be book selling and book signing upstairs in the library, in the lobby. To begin, Judith Jones is the senior editor and vice president at Alfred A. Knopf, where she has worked since 1957, editing some of the most culturally significant cookbooks of our time, including the one you all know, Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking. She is the co-author with her late husband, Evan Jones, of three books, including the Book of New England Cookery. She also collaborated on the L.L. Bean Game and Fish Cookbook and recently has contributed pieces to Vogue, Saveur, and Gourmet magazines. Her new memoir, The Tenth Muse, My Life in Food, recounts her relationship with gastronomes, including Julia Child, and chronicles her own food-related adventures in both Paris and New York. Our first presenter this evening, a veteran journalist whose work has appeared in numerous publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Vanity Fair, Alex Prudhomme, has covered everything from terrorism to kitchen design to biotechnology to murder. With his great aunt, Julia Child, as co-author, My Life in France is Prudhomme's memoir of Julia Child's formative years in Paris as she explored France, enrolled at Le Cordon Bleu, and established her remarkable tome, Mastering the Art of French Cooking. We are so honored to have them both with us here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming our guests, Judith Jones and Alex Prudhomme. Alex? Welcome.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. This is a great crowd. It's a great event. As a writer, I'm a big supporter of libraries. I actually spent a good amount of time in libraries writing this book. And one of the things we were just talking about at dinner is that you keep hearing that libraries don't get used these days. But in fact, if you actually go to the library, you see that's not true, that people are actually really using libraries. They're using libraries in new ways. They're using the Internet. They come here to get online, and then they realize that there are actually a lot of great resources all around them in the shape of books. And they realize that there are a lot of interesting people there, and so it becomes a social hub. And so I think in an ironic way that the Internet is kind of reinventing the library. So I'm a big supporter of this push that you all are involved in, and I hope you're generous and see it through to the end. My name is Alex Prudhomme. I'm Julia Child's great-nephew. I'm related to Julia by marriage. Her husband, Paul Child, was the twin brother of my grandfather, Charles Child. And so I was very lucky. I grew up with Julia, both knowing her as a celebrity on television. I used to watch her on my parents' little tiny black and white TV, and also as a member of the family. And there were funny moments once in a while. I lived in New York City, and Julia would come down to New York for an event, and she'd be on TV, and we'd be watching her. And then a half an hour later, the door would open, and Julia would walk into my parents' apartment. And when you're a little kid, you think, well, that's pretty cool. You know, she came out of the TV. And as I grew up, I realized that it was a little more complicated than that. But I had the great fortune of spending a lot of time with Julia and Paul, who never had kids of their own, but had a lot of surrogate children, people that they helped out, whether they were cooks or people that they literally met on the street and liked and invite over to their house for dinner, people like myself. Julia was a big part of my life. She and Paul lived in Cambridge, Mass., right behind Harvard, and had a little house in the south of France. And one of the best meals I ever had in my life was at their little house in France, which was called La Pichoune, which means the little thing. It's a house outside of Cannes. And it was the summer of 1976. And I remember that date because we were sitting on the back porch one day. It was very hot. Paul had a TV out, and we were watching the 1976 Summer Olympics from Montreal. And there was a wonderful Cuban boxer named Teofilo Stevenson. And Paul loved to watch this, and he was doing the play-by-play. He was translating for me from the French into English. Meanwhile, Julia was in the corner cooking the most delicious grilled chicken I've ever had in my life. And it was being cooked on the tiniest grill I've ever seen in my life. Literally, she could only cook one piece at a time. And she was talking along, and Paul was doing his play-by-play, and they were drinking rosé, and it was hot, and it was just one of those magical moments. And I'll never forget it. It was so delicious. And one of my great regrets is that I never got the recipe for the marinade of that chicken. As I grew up, I ended up having a career of my own as a writer. I was a magazine and newspaper writer for a long time, and then I got into doing books. And I had this fascinating great aunt, Julia Child, who I'd always wanted to work with. And for years and years, she'd been talking about doing a book, unlike her cookbooks, a book of stories, a memoir of the years that she lived in France, which were her favorite years of her life. Paul took Julia to France in 1948. We opened the book November 3rd, 1948. They've just come across the Atlantic through a terrible gale on the SS America, and they land in the port of Le Havre in the middle of a foggy, rainy day. And Julia is feeling a little intimidated because everything she's been told about the French leads her to be suspicious. She thinks the men are devious and are going to try to pinch her derriere. The women are going to be impossibly snobbish and chic. And here she is, 6'2", size 12 feet, loud American, unsophisticated, and she's feeling intimidated. I'll return to that in a minute. That's how we open the book. It's a memoir. It's a love story. It's not an encyclopedic autobiography at all. It's a collection of Julia's favorite stories of these favorite years of her life. As I said, she'd been talking about doing this book for years and years, and it never appeared. And my co-presenter tonight, Judith Jones, who you'll be hearing from in a second, was Julia's editor for over 40 years. And she had prodded Julia to do this book. And even with Judith's prodding, it never appeared. And so I occasionally would say, now, Julia, how's the France book going? What's happening with that? And she'd say, well, it's coming. It's coming. And yet it would never appear. And so finally, in December of 2003, when she was 91 years old and she had retired to Santa Barbara, I made my annual visit. I went out to see her. And we were sitting around in her living room. And I said, so, Julia, how's the France book going? And she said, well, dearie, it's not so good. I said, well, I'm here to help. And this time she said, well, maybe we ought to give it a try. And so we literally sat down the next day and began to work on the book. And I wasn't prepared. I didn't have a pad or a pen. I had to run out to the drugstore and get some material to work with. And I said, now, Julia, show me what you've done. I know you've been working on this book for a long time. And so she opened the drawer of her desk, and I was expecting to see a big pile of manuscript pages, but instead were these neatly cataloged manila envelopes full of airmail paper. It turns out these were letters that Julia and Paul had written to my grandparents from France every week describing what was going on. And it was like having a running diary. And Paul wrote very journalistic letters, very descriptive about the weather and what was happening geopolitically, what he was doing in the U.S. Embassy. He worked for the U.S. Information Service, which was a sort of a cultural propaganda entity. And Julia's were short, typed, full of misspellings and exclamation points, all about the marketplace and what she was cooking and the gossip. And so for a writer like me, this was like, I felt like a pirate coming over a treasure trove. It was amazing. And so we sat down and we began to sketch out the book, and we worked together for about 8 months, from January until August of 2004. And in mid-August, 2 days before her 92nd birthday, she passed away in her sleep from kidney failure. And it was my job to finish the book, and it took me another year to do so, each day of which I had a new question for her. Who was Mrs. McGillicuddy at the party? Why, of all things, did you serve brains simmered in red wine as your first meal for Paul? And more profound questions about, life and death. But I didn't have her there any longer, and so I had to return to the letters, and I had to look at her writings. And sometimes I had to kind of take all this stuff and weave it together and put it in Julia's voice. And it took a while. And hopefully the tone of the book is as if you're sitting at a little cafe table with her, perhaps having a glass of wine or a cup of coffee, and she's telling you some of her favorite stories. And so it's a book that some people like to read in one sitting. And other people like to pick through it as if it were tapas, a little bit here, a little bit there. It strikes different people in different ways. And I've been talking about the book across the country, and one of the things that I wasn't prepared for was the emotional reaction. I was expecting some sort of reaction because Julia had a very interesting life, and I was expecting lots of questions about her cooking and her education and her background and so on. But what I wasn't prepared for was having people come up to me, especially women, and bursting into tears and saying, "She changed my life." And the first time this happened, I was rendered speechless. After the seventh or eighth time, I was used to do it. But what I like about it is that Julia really, in her own very modest way, really reached out virtually through the television screen and through the pages of her book and affected people's lives. And I've talked to young chefs and people who say, if it weren't for Julia, I wouldn't have this life that I have now. So my hope for the book is that her very optimistic and positive view of life, along with some great stories, gets transmitted. And it's sort of a simple-sounding thing, but I think ultimately it's a pretty profound view of life. The lessons that she teaches about cooking can be applied to pretty much any area. So we open the book when they arrive off of France, and the book progresses from the early days. Paul is a diplomat, so he's very busy at the embassy. Julia is 36 when they arrive in France. She doesn't know how to speak French. She doesn't know how to cook. She doesn't know who she is or what she wants to be when she grows up. Paul was 10 years older than she was, a sophisticated man of the world who had lived in France in the 20s and had known people like Gertrude Stein and Hemingway, was fluent in French, was a wonderful gourmand and wine lover back before that was trendy. And he really tutors her, and he teaches her, and he pushes her. And after a year of living in Paris, she decides to sign up for the Cordon Bleu cooking school, where she has all sorts of adventures and misadventures, but learns not only how to cook, but how to shop in the French way, and how to teach. She learns from this wonderful mentor she had, Chef Max Bougnard, who is, you'll see in the book there are photographs of him. He's a quintessential French chef. He'd been trained under Escoffier. He'd had his own restaurant before the war. And he took a shine to Julia and really began to focus on her. She ultimately meets two French women who are similarly inclined, and they open a little cooking school. Then they create a book that becomes Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Volume 1, which is published in 1961, thanks to Judith. And we can get into all of that later, but I'm going to read to you a section from the beginning of the book about maybe one of the most important meals, certainly in her life, but maybe in American cultural history as well, because it's the meal where Julia has her epiphany. It's her first meal in France. So there they are. It's November of 1948. They're driving from Le Havre, the port, to Paris. And along the way, Paul pulls into... Oh, by the way, they're driving a big, giant, blue Buick station wagon. Loaded to the gills with all their stuff. And they call this car the Blue Flash. And they pull into Rouen, the beautiful old medieval town. And she says, at 12:30, we flashed into Rouen. We passed the city's ancient and beautiful clock tower and then its famous cathedral, still pockmarked from battle, but magnificent with its stained glass windows. We rolled to a stop in La Place du Vieux Marché, the square where Joan of Arc had met her fiery fate. There, the Guide Michelin directed us to Restaurant La Couronne, the Crown, which had been built in 1345 in a medieval quarter-timbered house. Paul strode ahead full of anticipation, but I hung back, concerned that I didn't look chic enough, that I wouldn't be able to communicate, and that the waiters would look down their long Gallic noses at us Yankee tourists. It was warm inside, and the dining room was a comfortably old-fashioned brown and white space, neither humble nor luxurious. At the far end was an enormous fireplace with a rotary spit on which something was cooking that sent out heavenly aromas. We were greeted by the maître d'hôtel, a slim, middle-aged man with dark hair who carried himself with an air of gentle seriousness. Paul spoke to him, and the maître d' smiled and said something back in a familiar way, as if they were old friends. Then he led us to a nice table not far from the fireplace. The other customers were all French, and I noticed that they were treated with exactly the same courtesy as we were. Nobody rolled their eyes at us or stuck their nose in the air. Actually, the staff seemed happy to see us. As we sat down, I heard two businessmen in gray suits at the next table asking questions of their waiter, an older, dignified man who gesticulated with the menu and answered them at length. "What are they talking about?" I whispered to Paul. "The waiter is telling them about the chicken they ordered," he whispered back. "How it was raised, how it will be cooked, what side dishes they can have with it, and which wines would go with it best." "Wine?" I said. "At lunch?" I had never drunk much wine other than some $1.19 California Burgundy, and certainly not in the middle of the day. In France, Paul explained, good cooking was regarded as a combination of national sport and high art, and wine was always served with lunch and dinner. "The trick," he said, "is moderation." Suddenly, the dining room filled with the wonderfully intermixing aromas that I sort of recognized but couldn't name. The first smell was something oniony. Shallots, Paul identified it, being sautéed in fresh butter. "What's a shallot?" I asked sheepishly. "You'll see," he said. Then came a warm and winey fragrance from the kitchen, which was probably a delicious sauce being reduced on the stove. This was followed by a whiff of something astringent, the salad dressing being tossed in a big ceramic bowl with lemon, wine vinegar, olive oil, and a few shakes of salt and pepper. My stomach gurgled with hunger. I couldn't help noticing that the waiters carried themselves with a quiet joy, as if their entire mission in life was to make their customers feel comfortable and well-tended. One of them glided up to my elbow. Glancing at the menu, Paul asked him questions in rapid-fire French. The waiter seemed to enjoy the back and forth with my husband. Oh, how I itched to be in on their conversation. Instead, I smiled and nodded uncomprehendingly, although I tried to absorb all that was going on around me. We began our lunch with a half dozen oysters on the half shell. I was used to the bland oysters from Washington and Massachusetts, which I had never cared much for. But this platter of Portuguese had a sensational, briny flavor and a smooth texture that was entirely new and surprising. The oysters were served with rounds of pain de seigle, a pale rye bread, with a spread of unsalted butter. Paul explained that, as with wine, the French have crus of butter, special regions that produce individually flavored butters. Beurre de Charente is a full-bodied butter usually recommended for pastry dough or general cooking. Beurre d'Isigny is a fine, light table butter. It was that delicious d'Isigny that we spread on our rounds of rye. Rouen is famous for its duck dishes, but after consulting the waiter, Paul had decided to order sole meunier. It arrived whole, a large, flat Dover sole that was perfectly browned in a sputtering butter sauce with a sprinkling of chopped parsley on top. The waiter carefully placed the platter in front of us, stepped back, and said, "Bon appétit." I closed my eyes and inhaled the rising perfume. Then I lifted a forkful of fish to my mouth, took a bite, and chewed slowly. The flesh of the sole was delicate, with a light but distinct taste of the ocean that blended marvelously with the brown butter. I chewed slowly and swallowed. It was a morsel of perfection. In Pasadena, we used to have broiled mackerel for Friday dinners, codfish balls with egg sauce, poached salmon on the 4th of July, and the occasional pan-fried trout when camping in the Sierras. But at La Couronne, I experienced fish and a dining experience of a higher order than any I'd ever had before. Along with our meal, we happily downed a whole bottle of Puy Fumé, a wonderfully crisp white wine from the Loire Valley. Another revelation. Then came salade verte laced with a lightly acidic vinaigrette, and I tasted my first real baguette, a crisp brown crust giving way to a slightly chewy, rather loosely textured pale yellow interior with a faint reminder of wheat and yeast in the odor and taste. Yum! We followed our meal with a leisurely dessert of fromage blanc and ended with a strong, dark café filtre. The waiter placed before us a cup topped with a metal canister which contained coffee grounds and boiling water. With some urging by us impatient drinkers, the water eventually filtered down into the cup below. It was fun, and it provided a distinctive dark brew. Paul paid the bill and chatted with the maitre d', telling him how much he looked forward to going back to Paris for the first time in 18 years. The maitre d' smiled as he scribbled something on the back of a card. "Tiens," he said, handing it to me. The Dorin family, who owned La Couronne, also owned a restaurant in Paris called La Truite, he explained, while Paul translated. On the card, he had scribbled a note of introduction for us. "Merci, monsieur," I said, with a flash of courage and an accent that sounded bad even to my own ear. The waiter nodded as if it were nothing and moved off to greet some new customers. Paul and I floated out the door into the brilliant sunshine and cool air. Our first lunch together in France had been absolute perfection. It was the most exciting meal of my life. Merci.
In some ways, it's very curious, but Julia and I led rather parallel lives. She was in France having those great experiences, which Alex just described, at exactly the same years that I was. We both came from very conservative families, and in a way, we found ourselves through our passion for food. But we never met until many years later. My family was English, and we never had garlic, onions, leeks, anything like that in the house. We were always blowing out the smells. It wasn't nice to smell of cooking. I mean, and you didn't talk about the table. You wouldn't have said yum. I mean, that was sort of like talking about sex at the table. Taboo. So when I got to France, it was like a great veil opening, and suddenly I could really enjoy food and get the pleasure in shopping. I even met somebody, and this is a long story, I won't tell you all tonight, but it is in the book, about how I started a little restaurant with a French beau, and it was in the Countess Catani's apartment, and it only lasted a few weeks. But anyway, so... And one of the things that started me writing was that I came upon this cache of letters after my mother died in her attic up in Vermont. And all the letters that I had written during that period from Paris. I couldn't believe this young girl, the cheeks she had, the manipulation. And I would write things like, the description of the Cirque du Cirque, which was the little restaurant I started. And I started out saying, I know that you didn't send me to an expensive college to have me become a cook, but I have been involved in this restaurant venture, and then I described it. And I also thought this was particularly cheeky. Dearest ones, it starts, about the question of cohabitation, one might call it. I know it is hard for you to accept the idea of gents and ladies living under one roof, but in practical terms of expense, it is not possible for me to live alone. The only way you can beat the rent racket is to get a large place and share it. And I couldn't stand living with four or five girls dormitory fashion, stockings drying all over the place. And then I described how they had a little cook. So that means I won't be cooking for the boys, which you were distressed about. But it's this constant note of trying to sell them the idea that in France, cooking is not something demeaning, it is an art. Anyway, when I got back after many happy years there and found the husband I wanted to be married to, and we got back to New York, it was a wasteland. And furthermore, although I had experienced this love of cooking and tried to learn from the butcher, the poissonnier, this and that, getting tips, I knew how much I really didn't know about French cooking, because you have, as in any art, you have to understand the techniques to perform well. And there simply weren't books like that. There were little formulas. The shorter the better, because the more recipes you could get into a book. And so I was quite desperate. And I had gone to the house of Alfred Knopf, a small personal publishing house, and on my desk one day appeared this huge tome by three women. Never heard of any of them. Julia Child, Lisette Berthold, Simone Beck. And I was asked to look at it, just get rid of it, really. But they thought I might be interested in the contents, and indeed I was. I took it home. I started cooking things from it. I made a perfect bourguignon. I understood what I was doing and why. And to me, it seemed like the answer to a prayer. Well, it developed that the boys up in Boston, the Houghton Mifflin people, who had been playing with this manuscript, this was the second submission, called Julia Child in and said, Mrs. Child, nobody in America wants to know that much about French cooking. Well, I did. And I just decided to go with it, and I went to Alfred Knopf and pleaded the case. And finally he said, well, let's let Mrs. Jones have her chance. And indeed he did. When I told him, too, that we had decided on a wonderful title, I said, it's going to be called Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And he shook his head and said, if a title by that name sells, I'll eat my hat. So he ate lots of hats. But anyway, it was the beginning of not only a great friendship, started by mail, because Julie was still in Oslo, and I have all the letters that went back and forth between us. And then finally she and Paul landed in my office one day, and I can't tell you how impressed I was by this absolutely natural, completely American, big slip college girl, but her love of cooking and her genuine determination to make America understand the difference between ordinary cooking or bad cooking, and cooking with real finesse, and to enjoy it. Anyway, we launched Mastering the Art of French Cooking very successfully, but the real turning point, of course, was when she got on television and seduced all of America. And finally, she released us from these terrible Puritan inhibitions and let us enjoy the sensuous nature of cooking, the creative part, have fun with it, and want to really do it well. And, of course, with the help of television, the book was, as you know, a huge success, and Julia became a household word in America. And I decided then that if she could do this for French cooking, there must be more people out there. And she had opened our taste buds, and we were embracing now new flavors from the Middle East, from Africa, from India, from China. But we needed great teachers. And so I really set about as an editor to look for people who might do for French cooking, for these exotic cookings, what Julia had done for French cooking. And I found very often, I found a number of people like Claudia Roden on Middle Eastern cooking, Malda Jaffrey on Indian cooking, Irene Kuo on Chinese cooking. And I found that they had something in common, which was they'd had to leave their homeland for one reason or another, and it was a way of recovering the past, of connecting to it, of telling the stories, and through taste, evoking memory. There's a lovely passage that I use from Claudia Roden. I'll just read you a little bit of it. But she discovered that celebrating these dishes was a way to get together, to rejoice in our food and summon the ghosts of the past. And then she describes about each dish filled our house in turn with the smells of the muski, the Caffro market, of the cornice in Alexandria, and so on. And she describes sending down the baskets to the merchants, the vendors, and pulling them up, and the women all sitting around and chatting and gossiping and stuffing little things, and the pleasure of it. And she ends, "It is these smells, emotions, habits, traditions, attached to and inseparable from our dishes, a small part of our distinctive cultures that I have tried to convey with food." And then both my husband and I, he wrote a lot about cooking, and we decided that he should do a book on American cooking, because American cooking, too, had been repressed. And what was the real story? How it was made up of so many parts, and they were beginning to surface again, the different characteristics. And so in the process, I became a great friend of James Beard, who was a sort of living example of everything he loved about food. It's hard to describe this great lumbering man who would just throw open the door of his refrigerator and say, "Let's make lunch." And wonderful with people. He always had time for somebody whose cake had fallen, and he'd be on the phone with them. And he introduced me to all kinds of people, including, well, that isn't actually through. Yes, it was Marion Cunningham, the woman I got to revamp Fanny Farmer, the Fanny Farmer of our generation. And I was introduced to her through their correspondence, and I couldn't believe. I began to know this woman just through these letters and her appreciation and sharing of tastes with Jim Beard. And then Edna Lewis, who came miraculously into my office one day. And I don't know whether you know about her, but she was from Virginia. Her great-grandfather was a slave, freed slave, and they'd started a community called Freetown, made up of a number of farms, and they all shared the harvester, the reaper, the planters. And food was just an essential part of that life. And she wrote so... She talked so beautifully about it, and I said, "Edna, I want your voice on paper." And she would go home and write it on long yellow pads. But it was that beautiful oral tradition that she just transcribed to paper and made this experience something really beautiful. Part of it was that food was a reward for hard work, and therefore it was a joy to cook it, to eat it, to share it, to take it to the church suppers. I think she's really one of the great voices of our American food literature. And then I also discovered in my own journey, when Evan and I got a place in northern Vermont, really remote on a mountain. And for the first time we had a garden, and we met a woman who was a naturalist, and she took us through the land and showed us all the things that we could just reap free from the land, wonderful fiddleheads and milkweed pods and wild sorrel. And I felt connected in a way as I never had before. And then later I met the mushroom lady who still has made people up in northern Vermont so aware of the abundance of wild mushrooms and sells them to chefs. And every week she comes like the good humor man up our driveway and brings me a little basket full of wild mushrooms. So this was a great awakening for me. And I like to read this passage from Wendell Berry because it expresses what I'm trying to say so beautifully. If you take away from food the wholeness of growing it, or take away the joy and conviviality of preparing it in your own home, then I believe you are talking about an entirely different kind of human being. That's so important because I felt that it was something we mustn't lose, which I think was one of the reasons that led me to write this book. And finally, I'd like to just talk a little bit about my own experience of being almost afraid after my husband died that I would no longer have this pleasure. I'll read you what I wrote. After Evan died in the winter of 1996, I doubted that I would ever find pleasure in making a nice meal for myself and sitting down to eat it alone. I was wrong. Instead, I realized that the ritual we had shared together for almost 50 years was a part of the rhythm of my life. And by honoring it, I kept alive something that was deeply ingrained in our relationship. In fact, more than ever, I found myself about mid-afternoon letting my mind drift to what I might conjure up for dinner when I got home. Instead of walking into what might have seemed an empty apartment, I gravitate toward the kitchen, as I did as a young girl. And I can't wait to bring it to life, to fill it with good smells, to start chopping or whisking or tossing and smelling up my hands with garlic. I turn on some music, have a glass of Campari or wine, and it is for me the best part of the day, a time for relaxation. When at last I sit down and light the candles, the place across from me is not empty. That and the fact that, as I remember that once, after we'd had a long day of shooting some television segment and getting down the recipes at Julia's up in Cambridge, and it must have been 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and Julia, we sat down in her dining room, and she fed the whole crew, and she lifted her glass, and she said, "Don't we have fun?" And I think of that. I also think of the fact that Lydia Bastianich taught me a wonderful expression that the Italians have. I have to read it because I don't get it quite right. A tavola non si invecchia. At the table, one never grows old. As Brielle Savarin wrote, the pleasures of the table are for every man of every land, and no matter of what place in history or society. They can be part of all his other pleasures, and they last the longest to console him when he has outlived the rest. So thank you, Julia, and all the wonderful mentors that I met over the years working with them.
Thank you to Judith and to Alex. At this point, we'll start the Q&A. If anybody would like to start us off with a question, please raise your hand. We'll get you a microphone on the aisle here.
Mrs. Jones, you skipped very fast over the transition from the book to the TV show. And I wondered if you could just say a little bit more about how the book was doing before the TV show came along and what exactly happened when the TV show hit.
Yeah, it was quite surprising because that fall that we published it of 61, we put out 10,000 copies and they were going well before Christmas and we had to do a second printing of 5,000. Now, that doesn't seem astronomical, but for a totally unknown author, authors, it was remarkable. And it got tremendous acceptance from Beard and Craig Claiborne, who was the food editor of the New York Times then. He said this book is a classic. And it was not until spring that she was on that program, and it wasn't until the next fall that the French Chef really went nationwide. So, and the book had was probably in about a third printing by then, but it never would have had the tremendous impact because Julia entered all our lives by being on that screen and enjoying herself and slapping the chicken and telling us to say yum yum.
I can fill in some of the blanks. She Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Volume 1, was published in October of 61, a month after I was born. And Paul and Julia were living in Cambridge, Mass. And during the war, they had been in the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the precursor to the CIA. And they had a friend from the OSS who was in Boston working at this fledgling public TV station, WGBH, Channel 2. And the friend said, you know, there's this book show we have here. It's called What I've Been Reading. And it's hosted by Professor Albert Duhamel. And Julia said, well, I'd love to come on. So she comes on to the show, but not only does she bring her book, being Julia, she brings a dozen eggs, a frying pan, a hot plate, some butter, and she proceeds to make an omelet in the French way. And she's having a terrific time, and she's so focused on making the omelet that she forgets to mention the title of her book. The good news is that all 23 people who saw the show that day wrote in and said, we want some more of that tall lady cooking. And the station wasn't ready for that. And they said, wow, that's interesting. So they signed her up for three pilot programs in 1962, each one of which went better than the last, and each one of which was more successful and got a bigger name. More and more letters started pouring in, more of that tall lady cooking. And so in 1963, they began the French Chef television series. And it's really fun to see some of the old shows. They've come back. They're being reissued now on DVD. You can get them probably here at the library or order them on Amazon or something. And one of the first ones, it may be the very first one, is Julia doing Boeuf Bourguignon, which sounds intimidating, but it's really just beef stew. And it's really pretty straightforward to make, and it's delicious. I made it last weekend, and it's fantastic. But what's so fun about that show is it's in black and white. It's a young-looking Julia. She's nervous, clearly. She's sweating. She's mopping her brow. She's looking at the wrong camera. At one point, she gets so flustered, she knocks over a whole pot full of spoons. But the food looks so good, and you can practically smell it. It's in black and white. Oh, yeah, that's the other thing. It's in black and white. And you want to just step through that TV screen and start cooking with her and sit down to eat. It's you see her magic all over again. And so those early shows are kind of a moment in time because there had been other people who'd had TV shows before Julia. Dion Lucas and Jim Beard had both tried and not done that well. They weren't natural on television. Julia had this innate ability to get in front of a camera and just light up. And the person that you saw on camera was the person that we knew. That's the way she really was. When she and I were working on this book together, it was just the two of us sitting in her living room. And she'd be cracking jokes and, you know, making little comments and talking about what movies were on and what was happening in politics. And it was, of course, the television persona was exaggerated. But the essence of Julia was the person that you saw on TV.
Another question. I'm right here in front. Ma'am, if you could wave the mic, please.
Thanks. I noticed that a lot of people in their 20s and 30s these days don't seem to cook a whole lot. And I don't know, kind of worries me because they are bringing up a whole generation of kids who don't have, you know, dinners at home and don't learn how to cook with their moms. So have you noticed that? Is it just maybe a, you know, an urban kind of thing, or will this too pass? What are your thoughts on that?
I notice it around the office with young people. I think two things, well, several things. First of all, I think we went too far in the celebrity chef business, and every dish so exotic, so expensive, so demanding. And then I think that the whole Food Network, the concentration is on entertainment, not on good teaching. That's not so true of PBS. I think Vidya Bastianich, for instance, is wonderful. But I think that's has sort of scared people off. More women are working, and actually a lot of men in young marriages are doing the cooking, if only on weekends and holidays and things, but cooking with the kids. But I feel the same way as you do, that somehow we need to lure them back to the kitchen and have more really helpful books, more accessible and better programs. Maybe we will. I think the whole cry that's gone up about the adulteration of our food and pointing out what we have allowed the food industry and the scientists to do, the nutritionists to do to our food, is going to affect young people, because I think they care about feeding their families well. And so something may come of it that could be really exciting if people heed it. It is expensive, but I think we've got to change our ways.
I actually have a different perspective on it. And this may be just local to where I live, which is Brooklyn, New York, but my sister is 7 years younger than I am, and she cooks a lot. The babysitters who come and take care of my kids who are college age or just a little bit younger are all into cooking. And I don't know whether that's because they live in a kind of a groovy part of New York. I have no sense of what's happening across the country. But I know in my particular neighborhood, people are cooking. The other thing is that when you live in a place like New York, you grow up with parents who take you to restaurants, and there's a green market down the street. And so you have access to things that maybe other people don't have. And so we're very lucky in that way. But as I've been doing readings from this book across the country, I've had a lot of young people come up to me and say, you know, I want to start a food blog. And I say, go for it. I have no idea what, you know, you're going to do with it, but that's great. You know, if you have the passion, that's fantastic.
Well, look at what Julie did with it.
Well, that's
not
right.
Tell about the...
Well, there's a woman named Julie Powell who wrote a book called Julie and Julia. And, The conceit of the book is that she was a secretary, basically, living in Queens, New York, after 9/11, and was miserable about her life. And in order to basically save herself, she cooked every single one of Julia Child's recipes from Mastering the Art of French Cooking in 1 year. And she blogged about it, and it became a hit. And so she turned it into a book. And... I'm glad to tell you that we are now combining our book with that book in a movie that's going to be written and directed by Nora Ephron. Meryl Streep will be playing Julia Child. Stanley Tucci will be playing Paul Child. Amy Adams plays Julie Powell. And the storyline cuts back and forth between Julie and Paul's kind of romantic life in Paris, juxtaposed to Julie Powell's less than romantic life in Queens. And what I like about it is that that Julie Powell stands in for a lot of people. She found herself through cooking. And, you know, Julia Child always saw herself primarily as a teacher. And to your point about the celebrityfication of cooking, I think that, you know, Julia... I'm surmising, she never said this to me, but I would surmise that Julia would say that on the one hand, it's a good thing because Americans are taking food more seriously now. They're paying attention. They're going to restaurants. They're buying interesting ingredients. They're demanding fresh produce. They're learning how to cook, or at least they're buying all that expensive gear. On the other hand, I think she would be dismayed by the sort of entertainment industrial complex thing that goes along with that, because she really was a genuine believer in good food, and she saw herself, again, as a teacher, but also as a student. She used to say to me, you know, I'm an eternal pupil. And I was, the hardcover version of the book, on the back flap is a photograph of me with Julia in her garden in Santa Barbara. It was taken by my wife. It was a beautiful sunny day. We had been working, and we were taking a break for lunch. My wife snapped the photograph, and 2 days later, she died in her sleep. It's a photo that memorializes the very last time we got together. But one of the interesting things that happened that day is Julia pulled me aside and started telling me all of these heartfelt things that she had obviously been thinking about and wanted to transmit. And one of them was that she said that here she was about to turn 92. Her health wasn't great, but she said, you know, I want to go lobster fishing, and I want to teach kids how to cook some more, and I want to go to a slaughterhouse. And she was, you know, she was still enthusiastic, basically on her deathbed. She wanted to go out and start traveling across the country. And I love that, because that is the essence of Julia. She was just so genuinely enthusiastic. And so what I hope that this movie does is to get Julia's message out to a whole new audience, these young people that you're talking about. It might, hopefully it'll turn them on. And, you know, what she wanted to do was to inspire people and to show them the path. This is the way to do it. You know, she was a believer in rules. There's a right way and a wrong way of doing things. And
she had no use for what she called the flimsies, didn't she?
That's right, that's right.
The people who only pretended to be interested in
right.
cooking.
Right.
Those babies, oh, don't pay attention to them.
And if you made a mistake, never apologize, she would say. yeah, no one knows what goes on in the kitchen, that's right. But in a related point, a lot of people from my generation and younger know Julia by the sort of comedic persona. They know the Dan Aykroyd impersonation of her on Saturday Night Live, which was funny, and she enjoyed it because it was done in good humor, you know, and she wasn't at all insulted. She thought it was hilarious. But the gist of that caricature is like, here's this drunken tall lady careening around the kitchen, cutting off her hand, you know. And the truth is that Julia was an extremely hard worker, an extremely rigorous technician. She really knew how to her knife work. She really knew technique. And so she had this wonderful, effervescent, embracing personality that got people enthusiastic and wanted to make you jump through the TV screen and start cooking bœuf bourguignon. But underneath that was a drill sergeant who said, you better do it right. You know, have fun, but get it right. So she was a little bit more complicated than people thought she was. And I think that message reverberates. And it's one of the reasons that I think that her books and her shows and her sort of life view sustain themselves, because it means something. It's not just fun and games. There's something real going on there. And personally, I feel that's what's lacking in some of the celebrity TV now. It's all the beautiful food shots and none of the real whatever that is, that stuff, you know.
Judith, I wonder if we could change courses a little bit. You've edited so many wonderful writers and cooks. Could you talk a bit about your relationship with MFK Fisher?
Yes, you know, we think of MFK Fisher today as a food writer, but she was a writer who just wrote about all elements of life, and particularly the sensual elements. And when she did her first books, I don't think America was quite ready for her, but she certainly found a tremendous audience for what she was saying as we became more sophisticated and released about food. And she had an extraordinary ability to almost get to know you through letters. She and I wrote to each other for about 6 years before we ever met. I would just send her the occasional book, and she'd see something that she loved in it and write me about it. And we became friends through these letters. And I remember the first time my husband and I were out in California, and we went to see her. And it was in St. Helena, and it was a scorchingly hot day. And she greeted us, and she took us down into the cellar, her dank cellar. And she'd set the table as though it were a little garden in Provence with a very, very simple lunch. And there we had lunch in the cellar. That was the beginning of a great, great friendship. And she was extraordinary.
Another question. Well, then I think it's time for us to say goodnight. Thank you to Judith Jones and Alex Trudeau.
Thank you all.
Please join us upstairs.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.